Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague, Peter Flaherty, and we are here before week five. We're already up to weekend five, Peter, of college baseball. We're going to recap some of what happened last weekend with the start of ACC and Big 12 play especially, and look ahead to this weekend. The big news this weekend, of course, is the start of SEC play. We also have a couple really big ACC series as well. So we're going to get into all sorts of stuff on this week's podcast. And Peter, I mean, we could mess around, but I think we just got to get right into it with what happened with last weekend, with the top 25, with Duke going into Winston-Salem and knocking off Wake Forest. As a result, we have a shakeup at the top of the Baseball America Top 25. Arkansas moves to number one. Wake Forest slides to seven. And Duke is all the way up to three, which is their highest ranking in the more than 40-year history of the Baseball America Top 25. So, I mean, we knew it was going to happen at some point. There's always, you know, you don't go very, 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 very rarely has anyone ever gone wire to wire at number one. So a month into the season, we have our first change, the first time the number one team loses a series, and it was a doozy for Wake Forest. But we'll get to that here in a second. But Peter, I mean, just what are your thoughts on I guess Arkansas rising, on Duke rising, on Wake falling, just on where we stand with the top 25 now?
I guess starting with the easy one, Arkansas rising to number one, like we talked about on our weekly top 25 call, it was a rather easy call to slide them up to number one, and not all that difficult when looking at the resume of the teams around them. They're 14-2. They have a really nice one run win over Oregon State. They've won, I think, now 10 in a row. They're firing on all cylinders. LSU had its little hiccup against Xavier over the weekend, and they have the best body of work of all of those teams. So that was an easy choice to make at one. But then switching gears a little bit to the Wake and Duke series, I don't know how bad of a take this is or how hot of a take it is, but I didn't think it was that great of a series. Like, game three on Sunday was extremely poorly played. Like, it felt like a midweek game. I know Duke came away with a really hard fought series win, and kind of armchairing it like this, you know.
Yeah, if you're Duke, you don't care how you got it done. But to, like, if you weren't paying attention over the weekend, Friday night was supposed to be this showdown between Jonathan Santucci of Duke and Josh Hartle of Wake, two of the best left-handers in the draft class, like first-round arms going at it. Neither one of them made it out of the fourth inning. Duke won the game. And then Saturday was a 6-3 win, I think it was, for Wake, and it wasn't even that close. Like, Wake was in control the whole time. Chase Burns pitched really well, like that. You got that out of the game, but Duke did score a couple runs in the ninth, but, you know, Wake was kind of in control the whole way. And then Sunday, as you're saying, Peter, it felt like a midweek game. Like, no starting pitching again. Errors, misplayed balls that couldn't have been errors. Like, it was just very sloppy. And if you're Duke, you don't care. You won. And if you're Wake, you don't really care either, probably. Like, there are a lot of things to address here from a viewership standpoint, from a, like, oh, look at this, like, exciting start to ACC play. We've got a top 15 series. It didn't live to that.
Yeah, it was super clunky. Friday, I as along with everyone, probably built this up as it was going to be some big-time pitcher's duel. Each starter would probably go at least six innings, look really good doing it. Neither had their sharpest stuff. And Duke's bullpen was outstanding. Owen Proch, Gabe Nard, and Charlie Bielanson, I think, combined to throw six and a third shutout innings. A.J. Gracia ended up playing the hero. He went 4-for-5 with two no-doubt home runs and five RBIs. And then on Saturday, you kind of knew where the game was headed with, like, you knew what kind of Chase Burns you were going to get probably by the end of the second inning. Everything was working for him. Fastball was electric, mixed in that hellacious power slider that looked every bit of a double plus offering, also mixed in a curveball and a changeup. Like, you knew no one was touching him that night. And the, like you said, the 6-3 score is probably a lot closer than it actually was. Like, there was little doubt that Wake was going to come away with a win. And then it set the stage for a rubber game on Sunday that was just, I mean, especially that fifth inning, but it was just a mess. There were free bases everywhere. Whatever the opposite of crisp play was, that's what was going on. I think Wake as a pitching staff or just as a whole, they gave Duke 20 free bases. And not to transition already to what happened yesterday on a pretty good midweek slate, Wake also gave Coastal, I believe, 23 free bases. So it's a legit issue for the Deeks. But when all said and done, Duke came away with a marquee series win, vaulted them all the way up to number 3 in the country. I think that even though they had a hiccup against Rider, which it's their second really weird hiccup of the season. They had that one Saturday loss to Akron and now this loss to Rider. And, you know, Rider was a regional team last year, but this year they started 1-9. They had scored just 10 total runs in their first 7 games, I believe. And RPI at this point is not totally worth looking at, but they were in the mid 200s in the RPI. Like, you dropped a stat yesterday on your Twitter where no team has hosted, I think, with 3 losses to teams RPI of 100 or worse. Maybe that the number is a little off, but I think Duke is going to host, but that is a really interesting nugget. So I think I can chalk that up to, or at least I'm chalking it up to, a lot of energy came out of this weekend series. They were a little bit sluggish going into yesterday, dragging a little bit. They get another crack at the Bronx today. I think it'll go a little bit different. But nonetheless, a marquee, notable series win on the road for Duke, taking down number 1 Wake. I think that they're a very, very complete club. They can really swing it. The offense proved that opening weekend especially, but nothing was an anomaly, even with the ball flying at Coastal and you know, the opponents that they played. The pitching staff is super, super deep. I love the bullpen that they have. I think that they've got 5-6 weapons, and they've had a couple of arms take that next step from last year. I think it has all the ingredients to make a big-time run in June and potentially break down that door to Omaha.
And then, so I want to talk about that bullpen, because I think that it is the strongest point on this Duke team, and that is interesting. And I think it also gets back to the question mark that now arises after the Rider loss. The exact thing is that last year, I didn't go back any further than last year. I just went to last year, and maybe I need to look into this a little deeper. Maybe it'll help me with my bracketology this year. But last year, no team hosted with more than 3 losses to opponents with RPIs of 100 plus on Selection Monday. So Rider and Akron are highly unlikely to be top 100 RPI teams on Selection Monday. Last year, Rider, which had a, like, they won like 37 games last year. Like, last year's Rider team was a really good team. They were 99 on Selection Monday. So this year's Rider team, which has started 2-9, and yeah, they've played tough competition, but like, at 2-9, good luck digging out of that hole to get to, like if Rider was barely a top 100 team a year ago, I don't think this year, even if they go out and they win the MAAC again, like, I don't think you're seeing them in the top 100 on Selection Monday. Akron, it's just not happening for them. Like, I love the MAC. I love Northeast Ohio. It's not happening for Akron. So if we take that and we say, like, Duke already has 2 quad 4 losses sitting here on May 13 as we record this, they have very little margin for error, because the 2 teams that hosted last year with those 3 quad 4 losses were Clemson and Coastal Carolina. And Clemson, all they did in the second half of last season was basically never lose an ACC game. So they were able to write off some of those bad early losses. And Coastal similarly dominated the Sun Belt. So if you're going to like go out and dominate your league, I guess it's okay. I don't think that the committee is going to sit there and be like, oh, well, three quad four losses, like you're okay. And then you take a fourth and they write it off. They write you off. Like, I don't think it's going to be that cut and dried at all. But I do think that Duke needs to be careful the rest of the way, because there are plenty of opportunities on their schedule. If you've already lost two of these games already, like there are more of these coming. And so I said I was going to talk about the bullpen, and I wind up waxing about that. But here's the thing, Peter, that I wonder about with Duke, and you're right that they absolutely could crash the door down and make it back to Omaha for the first time since 1961. And the bullpen is going to be a big part of the reason they get there if they do. But I also wonder, is the bullpen too much? Like, are they too reliant on the bullpen? This weekend, they won a series at Wake despite their starters giving up 13 runs in 10 and two-thirds innings. And like, that's great. They went on the road, they beat a really quality opponent, their starters had a bad weekend, and they won the series anyway. Great. Huge props to the bullpen. Because the bullpen, over 16 and a third, held the Deeks to 6 runs. And this is my favorite part of this, in the final 3 innings of all 3 games, the Duke bullpen did not allow a run. So your best relievers, not your middle guys, you know, the guys at the end, they really got it done. And Charlie Bilinson looks like one of the best closers in the country right now. The problem here, though, is like outside of Santucci, Duke doesn't like it, and Santucci doesn't have like a huge track record, but like the Duke starting rotation is not scary right now. And I think that those 3 guys are all capable of being really solid, but I just wonder if you're building your pitching staff this way. And it's the same way Duke built it last year, and they made it to a super regional, pushed Virginia to the limit in Charlottesville. But I just wonder, like, is this pitching staff built in a way that is going to hold up, or do they at some point need more from their starting pitchers?
It's an interesting point, but, and I might be rather alone in this camp, I thought this weekend was almost even more encouraging for the pitching staff. Like, Andrew Healy is someone, I know he didn't have his best stuff this weekend, but he's a lot better than what he showed. Like, I think he is a guy that once ACC play gets rolling and they get into the meat of their schedule, he's someone that can go out and give them 6, potentially even 7 really good innings on a rather consistent basis. 6 a lot more often than 7. Santucci obviously is not going to allow 5 earned and 2 2/3 innings every weekend out. Like, he's going to be a 6 to 7 inning guy. I think Sundays, like it is for so many teams around the country, Sundays are a little bit of a question mark, but Kyle Johnson is as good of a freshman arm as you can trot out there on Sundays. Like, he
actually had the longest start of any of those 3 this weekend. He went 4.
That's a great point. But he's a mega dude. And he's making his presence felt and making an impact on both sides of the baseball. But I mean, like you said, and it was a great point, the fact that the starting pitching can go out and do what they did, or lack thereof, I guess, and throw how they did and still come away with a series win on the road against the number one team in the country. I think that is a huge, huge testament to the depth that you have. Now, if it gets to be a trend where, I don't think it will, but if it gets to be a trend where Duke's starting pitching can't go deep into games, and they are heavily, heavily relying on their bullpen weekend in and weekend out, then maybe I'll be a little bit concerned. But I'm a real believer in Andrew Healy. Kyle Johnson, I think, like, even though he had a solid start by every stretch, I think he's even better than what he did. And then you've got these 5, 6, 7 weapons at least behind all these guys, and I think it bodes really well for him. But it is something to follow going forward.
Before we stop on this Duke bullpen discussion, just shout out Gabe Nard, Shaker Heights native. His dad's a podcast listener, so gotta get that in there. He pitched really well on Friday.
He did. He threw well Friday, and he's looked really good this year. So
that's 2.61 ERA. As of our recording, I don't know if he'll have pitched against Ryder or not, but pretty good. Pretty good for the sophomore. Wake Forest, now, they, you know, we talked last week when we were previewing this this series, and we were kind of hesitant to say, like, yeah, Wake's going to go out and win the series, which is not the way you would think about talking about a number one team in the country. And our concerns were borne out. And right now, Wake is, they're, I hesitate to say they're scuffling. They're like 14-4. But they just lost again on Tuesday, as Peter said. They lost at Wake. And honestly, right now, Peter, the way I see it, the problem is their stars aren't acting like stars. Like, we talk about them having 4 or 5 first-round potential-type players on the roster. And Chase Burns has absolutely lived up to that to this point. I don't think any of the rest of them really have. Like, they're all still likely first round picks, or, you know, they haven't moved off of their preseason thing. Nobody's done that poorly. And you could argue that Siver Kane is doing what he needs to do as well. But Nick Kurtz has not been Nick Kurtz. Like, he was an All-American last year. There's a reason why he came in a contender to be the first overall pick this year. He just, you know, he coming out of the weekend was hitting 220 with 2 home runs. At some point, he'll break out, but right now it's just way too easy to pitch around him, which Duke did all weekend long with no real consequences. Josh Hartle, 3-1, 422, was not good on Friday. He'll have better days, but, you know, it's not what you want. And, you know, Massey threw like 2 innings on Sunday. You know, he's been all right as the third starter, but certainly hasn't lit the world on fire. They've got some ancillary pieces stepping up, like Adam Tellier and Jack Winne have really done well offensively. But Wake, I just feel like Wake needs more out of its stars if it's going to be like number one Wake Forest.
So I'm very concerned about the pitching staff, not the starting pitching. Like, that rotation will remain one of, if not the most formidable three-headed monster in the country. Like you said, Burns is doing what was expected, arguably even exceeding it a little bit. Josh Hartle, I know the numbers right now look a little bit inflated, but that is due very much to what happened on Friday night. Like, other than that, he's turned in 3 quality starts. Michael Massey, I think that they'll look to have him pitch deeper into games. He had pitched exclusively out of the bullpen last year and really throughout his whole career. So it's still kind of a little bit of an adjustment period. He'll get stretched out. But as I wrote in my weekend preview for last week, and I think that until they prove otherwise, it's going to be a problem. Who is going to get outs in those last, let's say, even if every starter, if each starter goes 6 innings, who is going to get outs in those last 9 innings, or like 9 to 15 innings each weekend? Who is going to, like, who can you point to and say, go and get me 6 outs, go and get me 9 outs? I think William Ray is someone they can feel really confident in right now. He's a sidewinder. He's actually looked really good in all 8 of his appearances. And then outside of that, like, I don't know if you can point to a single arm on that pitching staff that you can feel really confident in and kind of sit back in the dugout and say, hey, watch this kid work. Like, he's going to, you know, blow this lineup away for a couple innings. Like, there's arm talent there. I am a little bit surprised. Like, Blake Morningstar has started to come into his own a little bit, and he kind of looks the part of someone who will be a weapon down the road. Zach Johnson gives you a funky look from the left side. I think he ends up being a viable option. Hayden LaFeu has looked really good at times. It's just been inconsistent. Cole Roland, getting him back, that's obviously going to be a big boost. There's talent there, but man, it's such a cliche, free bases kill you, but these last 2 games for the Deeks, they have kind of been the poster child for that. We mentioned 20 free bases to Duke on Sunday, and they still somehow only lose by 2 runs, which is weirdly impressive for a game that they were like giving away. And then on Tuesday, yesterday, at the time of this recording, they go to Conway and lose 17-9 to Coastal, which I know the score looks pretty lopsided, but I think it was 23 free bases yesterday. And it's just, if they play clean baseball, you know, who's to say what happens, but there's a really realistic chance that those are two wins instead of two losses, and they really got to clean it up. Like, it's super, super sloppy. Sunday against Duke, like we said, it looked like a midweek game. Yesterday really, really looked like a midweek game. And then flipping the page to the offense, I'm with you in that Nick Kurtz gets going. I think we had mentioned before recording, but I think he has an inevitable like 7-for-13 weekend where he gets 3 home runs and kind of gets rolling. Seaver King has started to come into form a little bit. I know he's off to a little bit of a slower start, but he looked good this weekend. He's swinging the bat a lot better. And then Adam Tellier and Jack Winne, similar to Gabe Nard and Shaker Heights, Jack Winne, a fellow alum of the Belmont Hill School. So shout out to Jack Winne. But those two guys, along with Jake Reinisch, who getting him back to form has been huge. So Tellier, Winne, and Reinisch, those three guys they've been leading the charge offensively. And they've looked really good. Like Tellier, we had tabbed before the year as kind of one of these unsung transfers. He has more than lived up to it. Jack Winne and Jake Reinisch have exceeded whatever breakout projection anyone had for them and potentially even the coaching staff had for them. So I think and it's weird to talk in like this, it's a complete reverse, but like if Seaver King and Nick Kurtz and Merrick Houston and Tate Ballesteros to an extent can round into form around them, now you're looking at a much more complete and dangerous lineup. But like you said, teams just aren't pitching in at Kurtz right now. And I'm mostly just concerned about that pitching staff, particularly the bullpen and, you know, the fourth starter. But this weekend against UVA is going to be a very, very interesting series.
Yeah, so let's spin this forward now. Coming out of this big weekend, Duke and Wake get no respite because Duke hosts Clemson and Wake goes to UVA. Now, Wake going to Virginia has become I thought it was going to be an interesting series because they were both going to be top 10 teams. Wake probably would be the number one team in the country. And, you know, we had UVA up to 8 last week. And then we already detailed Wake losing. UVA goes on the road to Miami and loses the first two games in ugly, ugly fashion before salvaging a win on Sunday. And suddenly that weekend in Charlottesville has a little more. It's not desperation, but there's something more to this series now. We're not going to call any series in the middle of March must win, but the loser of this weekend series in Charlottesville, be it UVA or Wake, is going to, you know, at best be 2-4 in the ACC and could be 1-5. Not the way you want to start conference play. And, you know, they're going to be asking some real questions because UVA had real issues on the mound again this weekend. That has continued. That has been a theme of the first month of the season, is UVA trying to shuffle its pitching staff to find something and coming up short, basically. You know, they've had some nice moments, but they just have not found what they're looking for on the mound yet. And, you know, Wake Forest is in a similar boat right now. So this weekend in Charlottesville, like there is some urgency to this series for sure.
If you thought I was concerned about Wake's pitching staff, sit down and let me tell you about UVA's pitching staff, because like Cullen McKay, that's the right guy to have on Fridays. He was excellent in a midweek starter role for the first, I think, 2 or 3 weeks of the season. He goes out, doesn't allow an earned run across 5 1/3 innings on Friday. UVA looked like it was in an excellent position to win that game, but its bullpen has just been brutal, for lack of a better term, to this point. And it hasn't just been this weekend. And then most notably on Saturday, the bullpen four arms combined to allow 13 earned runs. I think in the 13 earned runs came across two innings. Four arms across two innings combined to allow 13 earned runs. And I mean, that's a major, major issue. And then on Sunday, again, I know they came away with they salvaged the series, but again, the bullpen really struggled. I think two arms across an inning and a third combined to allow five earned runs. And the pitch, the starting rotation, McKay and Blanco, I think that's a solid 1-2 punch on Friday and Saturday. It's obviously not as scary as some of the other starting rotations in the country, but Colin McKay is a really good arm. I think Evan Blanco is a really solid lefty. I think that those two guys, you can feel very confident in getting at least five quality innings, 5 to 6 innings, that they're going to leave the game in a position for you to win. And then after that, the bullpen has been super, super, super iffy and really just not performing to this point. And then on Sundays, Jay Woolfolk, kind of similar to Mike, like Michael Massey has had more success than Woolfolk to this point, and I really like Jay Woolfolk. Like Jay Woolfolk was exclusively a reliever. He is just now making the transition to the rotation, and it's come with a lot of growing pains, I think more than anticipated. So it's like, what do you do there? And then if you move off of him on Sundays, you start to ask the question, who do you stick there? And there's really no obvious choice. Like Jack O'Connor struggled in a starting role early this, like they've already made some pretty drastic changes to the rotation and how to shuffle these guys, and there still hasn't been much of a change. So like guys are it sounds simple, but guys are just going to kind of like, they're just going to have to find it, or at least try and find it and step up, because what you see right now in terms of where guys are throwing and for how long, it, more or less, that's what you're going to get. But I think also with UVA, it's not all totally bad. I really like that lineup a lot, and it's exceeded my expectations for how well it's going to perform. Obviously, you have Griff O'Farrell and Ethan Anderson, who to this point honestly haven't been world beaters. But, you know, Casey Sauke and Harrison Didowick have both been outstanding. Star freshman Henry Ford has been great. You know, there are 6 to 7 bats in there that you have to be really concerned about as an opposing pitcher. But the pitching staff, man, they're on the struggle bus.
I wonder, and like, I'm sure UVA has considered this and hasn't done it for whatever reason to this point, but, you know, I wonder about Woolfolk moving back to the bullpen. Does that like unlock the bullpen by putting him in some sort of like relief ace role? And like, could you find somebody else to pitch on Sundays? But yeah, I mean, they're going to keep searching because that's all they can do at this point. But critical series in Charlottesville. Meanwhile, in Durham, Clemson did not start ACC play last week. So this is their opener of conference play. And I mean, Clemson really has done nothing wrong this year. We've talked about them a little bit, talked about them after the South Carolina series. I just feel like they're just really solid across the board. There's still some room for growth, but this is going to be a different test. The South Carolina series is a big test. It's kind of a unique setting, though, and they wound up not having to play the true road game in it. This one, going on the road, you know, it's not like Duke's there's no massive, like, Duke crowd waiting for them.
The hostile Jack Coombs environment.
Yeah, we're not going to worry about that at Coombs if you're Clemson, but you know, they do have to go on the road for the first time, and they have to face a team that's feeling really good about themselves having beaten Wake, assuming they don't trip up again against Ryder after we record this, which would potentially change some things. But I think Clemson gets a good test this weekend. I think they can go in there and win that series, but I am very much interested in how that one's going to shake out.
I'm with you. And I'm also with you in the fact that they absolutely can go in there and take at least 2 of 3. I think that for a team that's 14-1 and its only hiccup this season was a weird Friday night loss at the hands of what I think to be a really solid Kennesaw State team. They've flown really under the radar. You talk about depth. They've got a lot of it on both sides of the baseball. Cam Cannarella, the headliner, has picked up right where he left off, arguably even better than what he did last year as a true freshman. He's hitting 400 at this point, driving the ball a little bit more. And then it's a bunch of veterans that have stepped up, and that, you know, I like that a lot. Like, if you have a core of, you know, three or four veterans and experienced guys, I think that's going to carry you pretty far. And I know that they're probably not going to keep up this level of production, but Alden Mathis, Jimmy Obertop, and Andrew Chufo, they're hitting 400, 333, and 321 respectively with a little bit of power numbers. Like, those three guys have really done well. Blake Wright came into his own and has started to really come into his own. He's a fun player. And then I think Will Taylor, he's kind of lurking in the weeds a little bit as someone who has started to step up recently and who could really pop and get going at the perfect time for him. He's hitting sub 200 with five home runs. But the power is plus. He's a great defender in center field. He's kind of in a perfect position as ACC play gets rolling to be another arm that steps up, or to be another hitter that steps up. Nolan Naraki, a sophomore, he's enjoying a breakout season at this point. And then on the mound, I've been very, very impressed. And I think the rotation is very underrated. Tristan Smith he's a legit left-hander. He's looked like a potential top five round or so draft prospect. And then you bookend that with Aiden Nock on Sundays, a true freshman who has stepped up. And then that bullpen, you know, it's looked nails. And I think that this weekend is going to be a really interesting matchup, assuming that Duke goes into it with a, crazy to talk about it like this, but a bounce back win over Rider. I think it sets the stage for what's going to be a really good series. Ultimately, I think Duke wins a decisive game three on Sunday, but Clemson, I think, is going to be able to hang right with them and go punch for punch. And it is not going to be a weekend series where I come out any less confident about Clemson. And in a weird way, especially if it's a really hard fought series loss, potentially even like better about Clemson. Like, it's weird to say that, but if they can go on the road, hang with Duke, go punch for punch with one of the best teams in the country, I think that's very validating for Clemson.
I'm just going to say, I think Clemson wins this weekend. I don't know how. I don't know exactly how this one's going to shake out. But Clemson has just been so good, so consistent. And, they're going to be super confident. They've played at a really high level now for about a full calendar year under Eric Backich. And like, it was not too deep into April that the turnaround started last year. And they have not lost many ACC games in that time. And so I'm going to go with Clemson this weekend.
I like it. I really won't fight you on it at all, because I think it could go either way.
All right. We'll get into the start of SEC play here in a second, but first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. What I love about using Indeed is how it does a lot of that organizational work for me. I can sort through candidates. I can respond to them. I can schedule interviews all through Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses, including Baseball America, that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, Peter, SEC play opens this weekend, and we have some very intriguing matchups throughout the conference. I mean, you can really make a case for almost like there are seven SEC matchups, obviously, this weekend, and like a solid five or six of them like really have my attention. I'm very excited for this weekend's SEC slate. You've got undefeated Texas A&M going to Florida, which lost on Tuesday to Florida State, and is off to its worst start in a decade. So very interesting series there. You have Tennessee going to Alabama, Auburn going to Vanderbilt. Both of those are top 25 showdowns as well. And then honestly, like, I don't expect us to spend hardly any time on this, Peter, but I got to tell you, like, as great as those are, the series I'm maybe most interested in is Georgia, 17-1 Georgia, going to Kentucky. Kentucky coming off of a series loss to Kennesaw State. They're 14-3. Georgia's off to this insane start, but I mean, really, like, on the weekend, the competition has been very, very light, and I think it's fair to be skeptical of the Bulldogs right now. On the other hand, maybe they're good. I don't know. I can't wait to find out this weekend and over the next couple weeks as Georgia's schedule stiffens from here. But I guess we should probably start in Gainesville. Florida is, you know, like, they haven't lost a weekend series, and, you know, you can feel good about that if you're a Florida fan, I suppose. But they're also like 10-6. They just gave up 12 runs in a loss to Florida State. That's the most runs Florida State has scored against Florida since 2008, and they play at least three times a year. The pitching staff for Florida has the worst team ERA in the SEC right now at 5.72, which is stunning. Meanwhile, A&M rolling right along. They got a little bit of magic last night again to beat Sam Houston State in walk-off fashion. They needed it on Sunday to walk off Rhode Island. I think it's fair to be a little skeptical of A&M in the same way that I'm a little skeptical of Georgia. But the thing about A&M is the schedule has been a little bit better. Thought more highly of them coming into the year. On the other hand, this is their first like road environment. They played in Arlington one weekend against some Pac-12 teams. That was a road trip for them. It's a few hours, but like, this is a real road environment. And I don't know, like, I'm very interested in this weekend. I think A&M is going to come in with a lot more confidence than Florida's playing with right now. But like I said, this is going to be different for them going on the road and playing at Florida like this.
Yeah, it's a very big series for each team and for way different reasons. For A&M, it's their first big test this year. They're going to try and make a statement in the opening weekend of SEC play. And then with Florida, I mean, if they come out with a series loss, they're going to be sitting at best 11-8. And then at that point, you're kind of sitting there like, whoa, okay, you know, we're 20 games in and we're sitting at this point, you know. That's obviously not a good spot to be at. But with A&M, I really, really like this team. And it's crazy. I know that's crazy to say about a team that's 17-0. But even the schedule aside, and maybe the lack of marquee wins they have to this point, one, that they find ways to win game in and game out, it seems, which I think is, you know, a big testament to who they are. But I love the personnel that they have as well. Braden Montgomery and Jace LaViolette are the two big ones on offense, but the pieces around them and the supplemental pieces have also stepped up in a major way. Ted Burton is one, Caden Kent another, Hayden Schott, who is a 80 grade follow on Twitter, he's another one. And then in that star power breath, Gavin Grahovic, a true freshman, has hit the ground running. He's hitting over 340 with, I think, 20 RBIs, which ranks third on the team. And then the pitching staff has been outstanding. Ryan Prager and Justin Lampkin, between the two of them, they've thrown a combined 42 innings. And across those 42 innings, they have allowed two runs. They've notched 67 strikeouts, and they've walked just eight hitters. And that is about as lights out as you can get, especially in a starting rotation. And then you throw in these pieces around them, you know, namely Chris Cortez, who has been used both as a starter and reliever to this point, Shane Sadow, you know, Brock Peary has looked good. Josh Stewart has looked good. Zane Budmaev at times has looked good. Like, they're super, super deep on both sides of the baseball. They find ways to win. It's a really appealing blend of experience and newcomers. And I think the most unsung or like underrated part of this year's team, and I went on a random Twitter tangent about it like past midnight last night because it was pressing that much on my mind, but the team chemistry they have is like, that is so underrated. And it's clear they love to play with and for each other. And that quality, you know, every single championship winning team has that. And I'm not here to say that A&M is my national champion right now or anything like that, but I think that's going to get them really, really far. And like the Hayden Schott Fungo Golf videos, like, they're really funny to watch and they're pretty mindless. And on the surface, it's not a big deal, but and like his funny tweets are all, you get a good laugh at those, but it's very apparent like how loose they are and how much they enjoy each other's presence. And I think that's really cool to watch, because it's, you know, somewhat rare nowadays, but I really like this team for a lot of reasons. And then going to Florida, I know you'll probably have more on them, but again, I do think that the pitching staff, like, Cade Fisher is not a 7 ERA type of guy. He is bound to figure it out. Caglione he's lit the world on fire on both sides of the baseball. I think most impressive for me and everyone has been what he's looked like on the mound. Like, he's a completely new pitcher.
I get that he's like revamped all of that. I was looking at his numbers. I'm super impressed by his strikeout rate as a hitter. Like, that was supposed to be one of the big problems. He's only struck out like 5 times this year.
Yeah, he's got 11 walks to 7 Ks. He's still hitting for big time power. Like, even his outs are right on the barrel and absolutely sizzled. He's a one of one type talent. But getting back to the rest of the Gators, like, the freshmen have, like, they've looked and pitched like freshmen at this point. And, they're in a little bit of a precarious spot here. I feel a lot better about the lineup than I do the pitching staff, obviously. Like, Ty Evans has stepped up in a huge way. Cade Kierland as well. Colby Shelton has been fantastic. And Caglione is Caglione, but outside of Cags on the pitching staff, like, a handful of guys are going to really need to find it here, because in looking up and down the pitching staff, like, they're not waiting on anyone to come back. You can't really shuffle many pieces. Like, this is who they're going to work with and what they're going to have to work with. So I'm really curious to see who rounds into form, and how, like, what the final form of the Florida Gators look like.
So I could go like really deep on the Florida pitching staff right now. I've been like very heavily invested in this, and I maybe get deeper than I need to with Florida, or deeper than I would elsewhere. So like, I do apologize if like Florida fans are already sick of hearing me talk about their pitching, but like, I just spent so many years like writing about how great Florida is at developing pitching and everything. Like, I wrote a whole cover story about how Florida was pitching you. And so if Florida is going to have one of these years, A, it's kind of fair that I like don't just sit here and ignore it. And B, like, having like gone as in-depth as I did about like how Florida develops pitching and how they got to this point where they are one of the most successful pitching programs nationally, like year after year, I know a lot. So I like really want to dig in and find out like what's not working this year. And they're in a, like you said, they're in a really tough spot here. Their rotation of Cade Fisher, Liam Peterson, and Caglione has been unchanged since opening weekend. On Sunday, Kevin O'Sullivan told reporters in Gainesville that he would consider like changing the order, but they're not changing the names of the rotation right now. And that's because they don't really have anyone that's like knocking down the door demanding to be put in the rotation. And that's problematic because right now they really could use somebody else to step up. But it's also problematic that they might have to reshuffle this thing because there's a reason why Cags pitches on Sunday. And like the thing about two-way players is that as a coaching staff, you have to decide how do you deploy them? Like if they're a reliever, they basically have to close because otherwise it becomes entirely too complicated to use them. It's not 100% true, but there's a reason why you see most of them. If they're relievers, they're closers. If they're starters, they almost invariably pitch on Friday or Sunday because you want the player to be fresh in one aspect. Like if they start on Fridays, they are fresh for pitching. And then the rest of the weekend, they might be at a little less than 100% as a hitter, especially on Saturdays, they're recovering, but you live with that because you got the best out of them on the mound on Friday night. If they pitch on Sunday, you're living with maybe a little less than 100% on the mound because after playing in the field for 2 days, like they're not perfectly fresh, but you get the best out of their bat for 2 days. So that's why Cags is on Sunday, because that's how they evaluated it. If you move him to Friday, you change the evaluation, and hey, maybe that's what this Florida team needs. The lineup, as Peter said, is doing fine right now. The pitching staff is what needs the help. So maybe you need to put Cags on Friday and maybe that helps everybody else fall into line. And also maybe he's even better, which is a scary thought that he could be better on the mound. The problem right now is how to get him there. If that's what you want to do, he threw like 98 pitches on Sunday, which does not indicate like a, we're moving him up kind of situation. But like, even if you did, like, can you really move him up 2 days at once? And if you don't, you pitch him on Saturday, which is arguably the worst day to pitch a two-way player. Like that's kind of messy. And I don't even know like what the purpose of any of this really would be unless Cade Fisher or Liam Peterson is going to get it together. And oh, by the way, the bullpen hasn't been great either. Brandon Neely, your all SEC closer, has an ERA of 8 right now. All of this is to say Florida has some issues on the mound. It's the worst pitching staff that I can remember in like a decade at Florida. You can make an argument that 2021 after Hunter Barco got hurt was worse than this or equally bad or whatever. And that's fine. But like over a full season, like this is shocking. It's not going to stay this bad. Brandon Neely will figure it out. Like there's reason to believe that Liam Peterson will figure it out, that Cade Fisher will figure out, et cetera, et cetera. But like they have to figure it out because Florida is leaking bad losses already, and SEC play, they're going to pile up some losses. So I don't know. We have them 10 right now. And like, it's kind of crazy that this team that hasn't lost a series has fallen 5 spots in our rankings already. Like that's goes against a lot of our philosophies as top 25 producers, historically. But like, honestly, like, Peter, if they lose this weekend, I don't know if we can rank them. If they're 11-8, I don't know if we can rank them.
Well, you brought up my next point. Like, yes, we came into this week having them ranked 10, but if the Gators leave this weekend with, you know, they've got the midweek loss to Florida State, who I think, for what it's worth, is a damn good baseball team. That's a whole other
yeah point. That's not one of the bad losses Florida has. That one's fine.
Like, if they leave this weekend, like, 11-8, dare I say 10-9.
They're 10-9, there's no question they're gone.
Right. Even like 11-8 though, like I think they gotta win this series to potentially stay ranked, which is crazy to talk about. And then even looking beyond this week, like they have another in season in-state rivalry midweek game against Jacksonville, and then they go to the box next weekend before another game against Florida State. Like, it is a really, really tough 7 of 8 game stretch here for Florida State. Like, it is, it's gut check time for them.
And not to go back to the pitching staff, though, I'm about to. Honestly, like, this is like the worst possible matchup. I feel like the only way this could be worse is if they were going to College Station this weekend, because Florida as a pitching staff, their biggest problem is throwing strikes, which is wild if you like have followed Florida pitching over the last decade. Like Michael Robertson in 2018, Florida's the closer back then, he told me that like if you don't throw strikes, you're gonna get yelled at, and so you might as well just throw strikes, otherwise you're gonna have a problem there. And right now Florida has a problem because their pitchers aren't throwing enough strikes. And you're with A&M, you have one of the most disciplined, patient, foul off every other pitch offense in the country coming in. If you're not going to throw strikes, A&M is going to sit there and take them. And if you throw them strikes, they're going to try and foul them off until you make a mistake. Like, that is what Florida has to contend with this weekend. And like, buddy, that just feels like an awful matchup for Florida right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything you said. Like, you know, you talk about with UVA and Wake, you can't really have a must-win series in March. And this is still the case, obviously, for Florida. But this is as close to a must-win, I think, as you can find. And it's going to be an uphill battle and a really, really big test. And I'd pick A&M, and I know that's really not a hot take at all, but I know that Florida is gonna, you know, like they're gonna come out and try and right the ship as best they can. Like, they're gonna need someone to really step up on the pitching staff, whether it's Cade Fisher or Liam Peterson. One of those two guys is gonna have to turn in a quality start for them to have a chance.
Let's talk about these Auburn, Vanderbilt, and Alabama-Tennessee matchups. Peter, which of those intrigues you more and why?
I like Tennessee-Bama. I think it's just, in looking at the matchup, it's like, I just think it's the best matchup of the two. Tennessee at 17-1. Similarly to Clemson kind of flying under the radar at 14-1. For a 17-1 team, Tennessee is also largely flown under the radar. I know that they've played a really forgiving schedule to this point. They've won 16 in a row since their loss on the first Saturday of the year to Oklahoma. But I think in just watching them play, like, they are for real. That lineup is, when you talk about deep lineups, like, Tennessee fits that to a T, and Billy Amick has been really good. Blake Burke, Dylan Dreiling, like, 6 of those guys can really, really hurt you. 6 to 7 guys. And like, the resurgence of Kavaris Tears has been such a welcome boost to that team. I think he's a redshirt sophomore, played sparingly to this point, has found himself in an everyday role this spring. He's hitting over 400 with 5 home runs. I think he's 3rd on the team in RBIs. Billy Amick, I know that they were expecting him to be an impact bat, and everyone was expecting him to be an impact bat coming out of the portal. I don't think they foresaw him getting off to this gangbusters type start where he's hitting 370 with 9 home runs, 21 RBIs. He's consistently on the barrel. He's playing himself into a potential like comp round pick. Christian Moore has very sneakily like flown up draft boards. He's also hitting over 360. With 12 extra base hits, more walks than strikeouts. And then the pitching staff, it's been really, really good for the Vols. And this is without AJ Russell, who's been on the shelf for the last couple weeks with an injury. TBD as to when he's back and really what the injury itself is, but I know that they were not going to rush him considering the lack of firepower on the schedule. But Drew Beam has looked like Drew Beam. Big time strike thrower, changeup is flashing. AJ Causey, transfer from Jacksonville State. I'm happy he's gotten to be thrust into a bigger role, albeit at the expense of an AJ Russell injury. But he was someone I was excited about that they got in the portal and was probably going to be more of an unsung guy. But again, I'm happy he's able to shown his stuff on a bigger stage. He's a sidewinder up to 92, 93 with a really good slider. He's looked good. Nate Snead, Wichita State, like super, super deep team. And again, I know that they haven't played the best schedule. They haven't played a ton of world beaters, but I think that they're going to show that these wins and there's no flukiness about them, which is why I think that this weekend is a big series for them, because if they can go out and take two of three and win a series against a 15-2 Alabama team, who to their credit is also in an excellent ball club, that's going to be a big time statement, but they're going to have their work cut out for them. I love the makeup of this Alabama team. You talk about a little bit kind of like Clemson with experienced guys stepping up. This is, you know, this is kind of that on steroids, like Gage Miller, JUCO transfer, TJ McCants, veteran Ole Miss transfer, Evan Slight, veteran transfer from Rutgers, Ian Petrutz, veteran transfer from Maryland. Like, they're all swinging the bat really, really well. They bring invaluable, I guess, leadership skills to the clubhouse. And it's a very, like, they can beat you in a lot of ways. They can drive the ball over the yard. These are also really mature hitters who know what they're doing in the box. And then on the mound, obviously, Ben Hess is a day one type draft guy. He's looked really good other than one, I think, hiccup of a start. Greg Ferrone has really found it. Louisville transfer, like, that is a very, very viable option behind Ben Hess. And then the bullpen has thrown the ball really well. So, like, this is a real Clash of the Titans series. And in the SEC, even though Texas A&M and Florida is an intriguing series for a lot of reasons, I think that Tennessee and Bama might be the one I'm most excited for.
A couple points on this one. One, this is a rivalry. Like, we think about this more in football than anything else, I feel like. But it is a rivalry, and this has to be, like, the most impactful series between these two in more than a decade. Like, I started looking that up earlier this week and kind of abandoned the project. but, like, they have not faced each other as both teams being ranked in quite a long time. So that is really cool. Two, AJ Russell is probably going to pitch this weekend, according to Tony Vitello. Unclear on the role, unclear on when, unclear even if he will, but it sounds like he's trending towards a return this weekend. And I had a third note, but I don't remember what it was now. I'm with you, though. This is a really interesting series. And I think, it was Alabama's coming off of a loss to Southern Miss in the midweek. And, you know, now they've I know Rob Vaughn was very interested in seeing how they were going to respond to their first loss of the season when they lost to Dallas Baptist in the Frisco tournament. Now they have to respond to another loss, and they have to do it against a really tough opponent. So they do get home field advantage this weekend, which could be key. We'll see. I think this one's interesting. I am really interested in what's going on in Nashville as Auburn comes to town. We've talked plenty about Vanderbilt on this podcast, not as much about Auburn. Auburn's been just kind of humming along. And as the guy who was the Auburn believer coming into the year, probably more than anyone in the national media, I've been pleased to see that. But now this is a bigger test. Going on the road to Vanderbilt is going to be a tricky one for them. The offense has been pretty good. There's some pieces that they could use to get going even a little bit better than what they have to this point, like Chris Stanfield, who I loved a year ago. He's only hitting 265, and, you know, getting him unlocked at the top of the order kind of changes some things. I think this weekend is really interesting. Both of these teams are going to try to steal some bases. Like, it's just going to be a little bit different of a series from some of the other ones you're going to see around the SEC. And then the other really interesting thing about Auburn is that they skipped Joseph Gonzalez last weekend. And Joseph Gonzalez, like, that was not an injury-related thing, as I understand it. It was more of a something went wrong mechanically in his previous start against UConn, in which he got knocked around and did not get out of the first inning. They skipped it so that he could have more time to like work and correct his mechanics. They really need Joseph Gonzalez to be good this year. And if he was able to get in the lab and work it out, that's going to be, I'm just interested to see how he comes back from that, because they could use him in that rotation. They've had pretty good pitching to this point. Vanderbilt's going to be they've played good teams. Like when they were in the Jacksonville tournament, they had UVA, they had Wichita and Iowa, and you know, they played UConn, and Austin Peay last weekend is a pretty good opponent as well, but still going on the road to Vanderbilt is a different test.
Their biggest test, without a doubt, I think the Iowa win. I know Iowa to this point has struggled. I think that looks better on paper than people might realize, just given it was a Friday. It was when they got Brody Brecht.
Beating Iowa on any other day, unimpressive right now. Beating Brody Brecht, still impressive.
Right. So I think that's a sneaky, really good win. The Wichita win, I also think, is better than people realize. And then, like you said, their two hiccups were to UVA and then UConn and then Austin Peay last weekend, who, like you also said, is better than expected, but or just a really good team in its own right. But I think with Joseph Gonzalez, I don't know how that matchup profiles for him this weekend if he hops back in the rotation, because I guess flipping the page to Vanderbilt a little, we were sitting here a couple of weeks ago, they had won its series against Gonzaga, but in the least convincing way you could do it. They lost on Sunday. They blew a big lead, and they were sitting here at, I think it was 5-3. And since, like, we had a lot of questions about Vanderbilt and what they were going to do, and they're facing this tough week with Indiana State, Evansville, and then going down to Minute Maid. And all they've done is win since then. They've won 10 in a row. Most impressively, had that thrilling come from behind win over Texas. And then yesterday, being Tuesday, they had a really convincing 13-5 win over a solid Indiana team. And I think that they've come into form, especially recently, and they've looked really, really good doing it. Like, these have been loud, convincing statement-type wins, like the anti-Gonzaga series. And, the lineup, I think that they've really welcomed these big time contributions from veterans who had otherwise, you know, not been like necessarily super key pieces. Like Alan Espinal and Troy Leneve, most notably, Troy Leneve has been the most productive hitter on the team at this point. He leads the squad with 22 RBIs. Alan Espinal, who was always touted for his defensive ability and was kind of a highly touted freshman way back, he is finally rounded into form, and him stepping up has been huge. Cam Kozel, one of the most highly touted freshmen to make it to a college campus, he's exceeded his lofty expectations. He's sitting over 340, and RJ Austin at this point has kind of proven himself as one of the better players in the SEC. And Matthew Polk has been really good. Jack Bolger, Jacob Humphrey has been a nice supplemental piece. And then on the pitching side, like Bryce Cunningham has arguably been the team's best arm. And I think that says something when you are on a pitching staff that includes Devin Futrell and Carter Holton, who I know still, like, if you look at the back of the baseball card, you might not be totally blown away, but he's pitched way better than his 5 ERA suggests. And they've got some nice pieces in the bullpen. Sawyer Hawks, I think, is someone, once he rounds into form, is way, way better than the back of the baseball card looks. Ethan McElvain is a standout freshman. Grayson Carter throws absolute noise, but the strikes are an issue. I really hope Andrew Dukanich is okay after he left with a trainer last night. He felt, I forget the exact word that was used, but he felt like a
sting. I think it was something is the zing. Quote from Tim Corbin.
He felt a sting or a zing in his throwing arm, which you can kind of read the tea leaves on that one, but he had been excellent to this point. Like, again, I I think that they're a super, super deep club. And I'm also a fan of Auburn. Like you said, they've just been humming along. They're 13-3. They've just been really steady. No real, like, they've remained very consistent. And the offense, it's not necessarily a world-beating offense, but they have a handful of really nice pieces with Cooper Weiss and Cooper McMurray, Ike Irish, Mason Mainers. Derek Fabian has quietly really stepped up for them. I think he 21 RBIs or a third on the team, and then on the pitching staff, like, I don't know how Joseph Gonzalez will fare this weekend if they go back to him, but Connor McBride, Chase Alsup, and Carson Myers, like, that's a really solid trio that you have going for them. So I know you were the high guy on Auburn, and I know that they've perhaps exceeded it to this point, but I'm curious to see how they look this weekend in Nashville, because the schedule has been good, not great to this point, but it gets, you know, they've got the next month or so is a gauntlet, because they go to Vanderbilt, they take on South Alabama, who is a sneaky, really, really solid and dangerous team on next Tuesday. Then they play Arkansas, then they go to College Station, and then they host Tennessee. So this is, we're going to find out just how good Auburn is in pretty short order.
Yeah, it's a tough one. No doubt about that. They got to be ready for it. And that's life in the SEC for you. All right. I would also just point out that South Carolina goes to Ole Miss this weekend, and I am quite intrigued by that. But we'll if we have to talk about that one, we'll talk about it next week. We'll see where Ole Miss is at. Let's flip to the Big 12, where there was one big series last weekend and one series that was also very notable. This weekend is a little less interesting in the Big 12, I would say. No ranked matchups, but we'll see what comes out of it. But anyway, two notable results last weekend were Kansas upsetting TCU in Lawrence. Pretty significant series win for the Jayhawks, knocking the Horned Frogs from the ranks of the undefeated. Also, just to get a series win against the projected conference champ is a pretty good way to start conference play for any team, but especially for Kansas, a team that is trying to make it back to regionals for the first time in a decade. And then the other one was in Lubbock, as Texas came away with a massive series win against Texas Tech. Another gritty grind them out series was actually not all that good kind of weekends. Basically everything that we said about Duke beating Wake, you can say about Texas beating Texas Tech, down to the fact that their bullpen was what led them there. Also their offense, they scored 22 runs on Friday. It was an impressive weekend for the Horns. We talked about them a lot last week, how much they needed something like that. Well, they went out and they got it. And after the week that they had, they were on that four-game skid going into Lubbock. To be able to get the cathartic win on Friday night, then they lose on Saturday, but then they bounce back on Sunday, come from behind, get a really tough win in a really tough environment against a rival. I mean, they come out of Lubbock feeling way, way better about themselves.
Yeah, they really needed that. I think the state of the Big 12, even after this weekend, like, I still think it's TCU and everyone else. I know Kansas came away with a really impressive series win, and TCU looked really, really quiet on Friday and Saturday from an offensive standpoint. Texas needed that series win really just to kind of stay afloat and not let this thing get really out of hand for them. And we had mentioned it, like, it was the perfect weekend for Texas to potentially really get rolling with a rather forgiving schedule. Like, they come away with that series win in Lubbock. Then they have a series that they're at home for a while. They've got Washington this weekend. They've got two with Air Force next week. They've got a series with Baylor next weekend before going on the road to Kansas State, who, like, it's a good, not great team. It's a golden opportunity for them to rack up a lot of wins here and potentially get on a little bit of a streak. I'm not sure still how I feel about Texas as a whole. The pitching staff just concerns me outside of LeBaron Johnson Jr. I do think that the lineup is really good, though. Like Jared Thomas and Peyton Powell at the top, that's a legit 1-2 punch that they've got. Porter Brown getting going felt kind of inevitable, and he did so last weekend. Even before last weekend, he got going, but looked really good again last weekend. Max Bellew has quietly stepped up for him. He had I think he was co-Big 12 player of the week. They can swing it, without a doubt. I just, again, outside of LeBaron Johnson, I don't know where the outs are going to come from necessarily. And then with Texas Tech, it was a big weekend for the Red Raiders just because it was really the first time since the Shriners College Showdown on opening weekend. And I guess the Oregon State, random Oregon State midweek game the following Wednesday, where they had really, like, for lack of a better term, played a team with a pulse necessarily. And it was tough to come away with that with a series loss, because now you're looking at their schedule for like a marquee win. And I guess it's Oregon, 11-7 over Oregon. And then it's a little bit of a lull before they can kind of, you know, play another formidable team. Like, I have no doubt that they're going to rack up a lot of wins. I'm just curious what that resume is going to look like. Typical of Texas Tech teams, they can really swing it. Damian Bravo has stepped up in a major, major way, and so has true freshman TJ Pompey. Bravo's hitting .500, and I think his 14 doubles lead the country. Pompey is going to be a really good one for him. Gavin Cash has looked solid. And then on the pitching staff again, like,
that's where the questions are.
It's really iffy. Mac Hoyer, freshman's looked really good. Kyle Robinson at times has looked solid. And then outside of those two, it's like very murky. So Texas Tech, at least for me, won't have the chance to make a statement barring some like crazy loud result for a little while, but still intrigued by the Red Raiders, more so now with Texas, because I think that, you know, they built up a lot of momentum that they can really kind of get rolling here.
Yeah, Texas has 9 more. Like, they're at a 10-game homestand. They started it Tuesday. They've got 9 more straight at home. This is a chance for them to really figure whatever ails them out. And both of these teams' pitching staffs are very interesting. Tech has like a 6 ERA coming out of the weekend. I don't know what it is. I don't even know if they played Tuesday. But like, that's problematic, obviously. And it's always hard to pitch in Lubbock. They've played a ton of games in Lubbock. But they also, as Peter has said, had not played much of a difficult schedule. And they are still giving up runs. So that's something to watch going forward. Texas, we've detailed their pitching woes previously. They also need to work them out. It was a very bullpen-heavy weekend for the Horns. LeBaron didn't even go terribly deep on Friday. I think he went 4. If that is the path that Texas winds up taking, that they have to do it mostly with the bullpen, I mean, it can work. Just look at Duke. It's a little bit different than what I thought it would be. But, you know, they do have a chance here to try and work some things out over the next few weeks here.
One more point on Texas, and I would have been remiss if I didn't mention it. Like, LeBaron Johnson's a great arm, and I think that, like, the pitching issues and the pitching question marks, it's the reverse of, like, a Wake Forest. Like, or I don't even know what I'm saying. The bullpen, like, they have weapons in the bullpen. Grant Fontenot, Max Grubbs, and Gage Bohm, those are three guys who have looked really good. Even Andre Duplantier to a little bit of a lesser extent, just due to the sample size. But those are three really good arms they have in the bullpen. I just wanted to mention it.
Yeah, and Easton Tumas threw really well on Sunday as well. They leaned really heavily on the bullpen on Sunday. I think they got one inning out of their starter. So, you know, it was that kind of day. On TCU, I'm just kind of just willing to write them a pass for this weekend. It's not great that their first road test, they failed. And frankly, they could have gone swept. They won handily on Sunday, but they scored like 8 runs in the 8th or the 9th. Like, they were, KU was right there with them all day on Sunday, basically, until the end. And the Frogs' offense is still really good. And they got held to 4 hits apiece on Friday and Saturday. And I'm just going to believe in the TCU offense more than say like there's a problem here. I do. There are some real issues though. Like they play too many close games. They started 13-0, but they were constantly in trouble. And the bullpen is a real strength, but they need to quit putting pressure on it. They need more out of their starters. I mean, we've said that many times, and hey, that's just what baseball is at this point, but like they need more out of their starters if they're they cannot constantly be asking their offense to come back out of deficits and their bullpen to hold them close in games. It's too much too much pressure on those two groups. Their rotation at some point has to come through for them.
Yeah, this kind of weekend, or at least the Friday and Saturday games, it kind of felt inevitable just with how much they were on the ropes early on. It just felt like they were due for, you know, a loss or two. And then I was impressed with, I know it was a midweek game and you'd only take so much out of it. I was impressed with how they bounced back yesterday, going to number 20 Dallas Baptist and notching a really nice road win. I'm like, this weekend did not make me overly concerned about TCU. Like, I am curious to see how the bats look going forward. It's a solid offense. It's a better than solid, honestly, on paper with the pieces that they have, but I'm curious to see like if Anthony Silva can really get rolling, if Carson Bowen can start swinging it a little better. But for the most part, I like the pieces that they have. And then I'm with you. They do need more out of the starting rotation, because for as good as the bullpen is, like we've mentioned a few times, like you can only rely on that model, like the bullpen type model, for so long. They have a good rotation, like Peyton Tolley and Cole Klecker, like those two guys. I think that they're going to really come into form. I'm not overly concerned. And I think that, again, just how TCU has done, like they play their best baseball at the perfect time. So this weekend, like, yeah, you obviously don't want to lose a series and you don't want to lose your first conference series and kind of your first road test, like just the optics of it. But it didn't really waver how I feel or change how I feel on TCU at all.
I think this is still true. I did not double check this after last night's game, but TCU through the weekend anyway, only five times has a starter gone more than five innings, and it only has two quality starts on the year. Like, if you're going to play until the end of June, which is what they're trying to do, like, you just, that's just so much pressure on the bullpen. Like, if you want to ride the bullpen in May and June, like, that's fine. That's what it's there for. But you don't want to tax them in February and March because you want them to be fresh at the end of the year. So that's my only concern with them. And hey, maybe that's the way they're setting it up. Maybe they're setting it up to build from the back. Maybe that was the plan the whole time, in which case, like, this is, you got the relievers into a position to do this, but it just doesn't feel like, it feels like their rotation should be able to do more than what they've done to this point. KU up and down. They're 9-6. They lost in extra innings to Mizzou on Tuesday night. First top five series win since 2010. First series win to open Big 12 play since 2014, which is wild. I don't know what to make of them at this point. I don't think that this is going to be a bad weekend. Like, looking back at this, like, TCU is not going to be like, ugh, that's really killing our RPI. I also don't know. Like, it's a great building block for Kansas, but I don't know that they still need to build on this. You know, like, this has to be a springboard to something, not like this did not go in and verify what we had already seen. Like, this has to be the springboard to something else.
Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly. Like, I'm curious to see, like, how they can build on it. It was a little bit of a step back, unfortunately, yesterday with a home loss to Missouri and a Missouri team that really has not been good at all to this point. But they have some quality pieces on both sides of the baseball. It's a really intriguing team. Like you said, I don't really know exactly what to make of it, but they're certainly not going to be a team that people are going to be, like, kicking themselves that they lost a series to, because I think that they're going to be very, very competitive in most, if not, you know, all of their series.
Out West, Pac-12 also started play last weekend. It was not eventful, I would say, except that Cal swept UCLA, and UCLA, after losing on Tuesday night, is 5-10. I have not had time to dig into that the way that I've had time to dig into, say, Florida. So I'll probably do that sometime over the next week, see what I can find there. But what I can say is that Cal is off to a really nice start. They go to Oregon this weekend, which won at Arizona State. And we talked last week about, like, who is going to challenge Oregon State at the top of this conference? Like, who can be, who at least can finish second to the Beavers, if not truly challenge them? And I think that our answer right now is Cal and Oregon are the two teams to watch out of the Pac-12.
Yeah, not to go too deep into the Pac-12, but when diving into the problems of some of these teams, like USC, Stanford, and UCLA, I'll keep it simple for you. They can't hit. Like, and that's not speaking hyperbolically. Like, they cannot hit. I think UCLA, like, outside of, you know, Cody Schreier and Deuce Gorson, they are really struggling to find guys to step up. South USC and Stanford, even more so than that. But then on a more positive note with Cal and Oregon, I think coming out of this weekend, you know, that'll give us the answer, at least for me, as to who I think will, I guess, be the biggest challenger to Oregon State, or I guess will is now kind of definitively playing second fiddle. But I love this Cal team a lot. Like, it's a very interesting blend of guys. They've got star power with Caleb Lomavita and Rodney Green. They're getting Ian May back on the mound at some point, which will be a huge addition. And they've, like, there are some interesting pieces on the mound. I know that the bullpen has been really inconsistent. They'd be even better than their record shows if the bullpen was better, but PJ Mutsuritis on offense, Jaron Advincula has looked good. Carson Crawford has, like, kind of finally stepped up. Peyton Schulze has been a nice veteran piece. Like, I love the kind of the makeup of this team, and they're certainly a regional caliber team. I know that we've even kicked around the idea of potentially ranking them to this point. At the
they're
very
in the discussion.
Least, they've been in our de facto, like, others receiving votes type of section, but they're a really fun team, and I like, this is a super, super intriguing, like, under the radar type series out West.
Yeah, I'm interested in how this one shakes out. I also guess I should maybe mention that Utah is not terrible. Question mark. They won a series against Washington State last weekend. They're 11-4 overall, and they host Oregon State this weekend. Oregon State was not in conference play last weekend, so start of conference play for the Beavers is going to 11-4 Utah. So I don't know, maybe that's a little something. And minimally, it's Gary Henderson, coach of Utah, taking on his alma mater. So little under the radar storyline. But after that, they go to Cal. So we'll find out how real this Utah start is. But at least right now, 11-4, 2-1 in the Pac-12. Shouts to the Utes.
Yeah, and this it'll be a very interesting, like, measure of, you know, just how good they are this weekend and how they stack up against one of the best teams in college baseball. So, fun one.
That's going to do it for us here. It's not a great weekend outside the major conferences. The Sun Belt starts its conference play this weekend as well. Not an amazing array of matchups, I would say. Still a couple weeks away from Conference USA or the Big Ten. And so if you're not playing conference baseball right now, like, it's hard for me to, like, really lock in, because these other leagues are now playing games that really, really matter. So that's why this was a more of a major conference focused episode. We'll try and get some of those mid-majors to come down the line, but hopefully we'll get another great weekend, especially as we get the SEC underway. Those series look very interesting, and we'll have plenty to talk about, I am sure, next week on the Baseball America College Podcast. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America Podcast wherever you get your podcast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you find it. Hit that subscribe button. You can follow Peter and me on Twitter. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. I'm at Ted Cahill, and all of our writing can be found over at baseballamerica.com, where it's always a great time to subscribe, but especially right now because, you know, spring training, we got those breakout series prospect games happening in spring training. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can read all about that stuff as well if you're curious. Fantasy drafting, we've got tools for you to help you with that. So check out the website as well. And we'll be back here next week with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Until then, enjoy the baseball.